is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 189, covering the week of September 30th through October 4th, 2019. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute. Like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and of course, subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. If you want to search for all those social media accounts, just go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll find all our social media buttons. You'll also see that little Amazon button. Click on that. While you're shopping at Amazon, you can make us your preferred nonprofit organization. We get a few pennies every time you shop at Amazon. It's a great way to support the Institute, and it's absolutely painless. You don't have to do anything but shop at Amazon like you normally do. You can also support the Institute while you're there by clicking on that Support tab. It'll drop down. It'll give you donor options. You can donate monthly, annually, or a one-time gift, and all of your donations are tax-deductible to the full extent of the law. You can also click on that Support tab and click on the Shop button. It'll take you out to our online apparel store where you can get your Abbeville Institute apparel. You can get golf shirts, t-shirts, hats, golf towels. Great way to support the Institute and also advertise the Institute as well. So it's a win-win. You get great apparel. It's embroidered, nice stuff, and you also help the Institute with a little change and with some advertising. So you can support the Institute that way. Show your faith in what we do, where we explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Also, don't forget to share our material around on social media and download our free mobile application. Just go to your mobile app store, wherever that is, on your Apple device or Android device, and download that mobile app. You get our podcast on the go. You get our lectures on the go. You get access to the website, all kinds of great stuff. It is a great way to keep up with the Institute and what we're doing and show that you like us. And of course, rate this podcast on wherever you get your podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get it, rate it. Because the more ratings we get, the more views we get, and the better we're going to be. So all kinds of ways to support the Institute, all kinds of ways to support what we do. It's as simple as just sharing our stuff around or sharing it with your friends, getting that daily dose of Dixie. If you give us an email address on the webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org, we'll give you a free ebook. And of course, you get that daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and a weekly email on Saturday or Sunday. Share those around too. Forward them to your friends. Great way to help support the Institute and our articles and what we do on a daily basis. Okay, that said, let's talk about the material we had this week. A lot of interesting stuff, and I think in some ways it looks to be rather eclectic. We have little pieces here and there, but I think all of it goes back to, as everything we do, it's without stating it, it goes to the Southern tradition. So this first piece of the week is interesting. It's by Brett Moffitt, and it's on September 30th, and it's George Mason's Boxwoods, right? And it's Gunston Hall's Boxwoods, but it's George Mason's Boxwoods. And if you're not familiar with George Mason, I mean, look, George Mason is one of those quintessential Southern gentlemen. He is one of the most important members of the founding generation. Not one that, of course, is in the Big Six. And by the Big Six, of course, it's Washington and Jefferson and Madison and Adams and Hamilton and Franklin. Those are the Big Six. But without George Mason, we probably don't have the Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution. Mason was one of the most ardent opponents of the Constitution at the Virginia Ratifying Convention. He had one of the best lines of the entire convention when people were, I mean, at that point, Mason was getting up there in age. And one of the younger delegates remarked that Mason had lost his wits. And so Mason walked right up to him and said, "When you lose yours, sir, no one will notice." And essentially cut the guy down to nothing. George Mason was an ardent defender of the ancient constitutions of the American colonists. He was a tie to that colonial period when the founding generation were concerned about what the British were doing because they believed it was a constitutional violation they were fighting against, not anything else. It wasn't some metaphysical, you know, ideological problem. This was a real, concrete, visceral abuse of power by the British, and it was unconstitutional. Mason, in his Virginia Resolves, essentially said as much. Mason, who helped draft the Virginia Constitution and The Virginia Declaration of Rights. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, where Jefferson says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they're endowed by the Creator of certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Mason said that, of course, Virginia had to protect life, liberty, and property, which equals, and I'm paraphrasing, which equals happiness. So, I mean, that phrase was taken from George Mason, right? So George Mason is one of the most important members of the founding generation. And if you've been to Gunson Hall, he has a beautiful garden, an English garden. Again, no clearer connection to the Cavalier lifestyle than George Mason's house. And you've got these boxwoods in this garden, which, of course, that's very English to have boxwoods, based on the country houses that you would find in England, or then Great Britain. Now, these plants are 230 years old, and there's been a decision made to dig them up, that they've reached the end of their life, that it's time to dig them up. And as Brett Moffat points out, and he goes through a long piece about the abuse of power by the general government, of course, Mason's home essentially is overlooking Washington, D.C., Gunston Hall. He points out that these boxwoods have been there this entire time, 230 years. These boxwoods have been at Gunston Hall. And how much has changed in that time, and what these boxwoods truly represent. They are a symbol of the Old South. More than anything else, this garden, this George Mason's country garden, his English garden, is a symbol of the Old South. And by tearing them up, that's taking out one more example of tearing up and taking down the Old South. They represent, the roots represent that tradition. They represent order. They represent the permanent things, and as Moffat says this, the permanent things in Southern society. And it's just unfortunate this decision has been made not try to save them a little longer. But this is where we are in 2019. The permanent things are coming undone. And they're coming undone not because the progressive left is causing them to come undone. They're coming undone because, as Boyd Cathy points out in the bookend piece on Friday, quote-unquote conservatives are insisting that they come undone. You see, the real problem with the Southern tradition is not the left, because you expect the progressives, the left, to attack the Southern tradition because they attack these permanent things. I mean, this is something Mel Bradford has pointed out for years. They want to undo the permanent things. Russell Kirk, I mean, this is what these people were saying. The permanent things matter, and the progressives want to tear those down. This is by their nature. This is what they want to do. This is why I find it absolutely hilarious when people call Calhoun a progressive, because he was interested in the permanent things and the American principles of self-government. These are the things that he wanted. But regardless, you have conservatives, as Boyd Cathy points out, like David French or Dennis Prager or Victor Davis Hanson, Conservative Inc., the establishment conservatives, are interested in tearing down permanent things daily. The video that Alan Gelzo produced for PragerU, and Alan Gelzo calls himself a conservative. We know that he's not, but the video that he produced is indicative of the modern conservative movement in that it's an acceptance of a progressive agenda from the late 19th century. It's an acceptance of illegal acts by the general government, all in the name of the proposition nation. Larry Arn, for example, at Hillsdale College. This is what they believe, that we have a proposition nation. That the Declaration of Independence, that document where it says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," that is a founding principle of the United States. But, of course, as Jefferson himself said, it really meant nothing. It was an expression of the American mind, but it meant nothing beyond that. So we have a situation where conservatives have adopted the radical Republican positions of the middle of the 19th century in Reconstruction, not understanding that by doing that, you're essentially saying we want to tear down Western civilization and the conservative tradition in America. Because as you tear down the South has always been the anchor to American conservatism. It has always been that way. Even in the 19th century, Europeans recognized that the South was that. H.L. Mencken recognized that the Old South was really the conservative anchor to America. And that if you get rid of that, If you get rid of that flywheel, the whole thing falls apart. It just flies into pieces. We're seeing it. It goes crazy. When the South was America, when the Southern tradition controlled things, this is when you had the most conservative America. And I know people, well, it was all about race. Well, it's not. If you look at Mason, here's a man that was very interested in civil liberties and the rights of Englishmen. He's critical of slavery. He was a quintessential member of the founding generation. This is what he believed. He's critical of the slave trade. Yes, he was a slave owner. But he wrestled with that his entire life. So Mason represents what's the best of America. Thomas Jefferson represents what's the best of America. These people and their in that adherence to tradition. I know you can say Jefferson was a radical, but his radicalism stopped in Virginia. He didn't look beyond his mountains. He didn't want to transform Massachusetts, for example. Massachusetts could do what Massachusetts wanted to do because he thought that was an alien place. Virginia was his country, and that's all he was concerned about. That is an important part of Jefferson's political legacy. As Kevin Gutzman in his most recent biography of Thomas Jefferson pointed out, look, he was committed to federalism. That was one of the things that Jefferson committed to his entire life. And because he was committed to federalism, all these other issues were irrelevant outside of Virginia. I mean, he could want to reform Virginia's education, Virginia's social system, whatever it was. He could want to reform all of these things. But that reform stopped at his mountains. And so these people represent the best. I mean, Washington represents what's the best. I mean, look, George Washington was not a Yankee. George Washington was a Southerner. George Washington was the archetype of the Southern gentleman. This was the guy that everyone wanted to be. So that is the important part of the Southern tradition. And by tearing this down, when David French or Dennis Prager or Alan Gelzo or take your pick, Larry Arnn, when these people tear down the South, which is what they're doing, they're tearing down American conservatism. And they don't even realize they're doing it, which is a sad thing. They're more in line with Eric Foner, who's a Marxist, than anything else. They don't even realize they're doing it. Lincoln was by no means a conservative. Now, you could say that Lincoln was not as far left as the radical Republicans, and certainly he wasn't. But he was by no means a conservative. So, or he didn't really believe in the American tradition of decentralization. I mean, that's one thing that he didn't believe in, without question. So you have this belief system in place from these individuals that says, you know, we have this conservative ink, which wants to tear down the South, and ripping up the boxwoods is part of that. And then you look at the other couple of pieces, the piece on Thursday by Michael Martin, where he gets into the red flag laws that are now being bandied about by the central government, essentially creating a social credit system like you have in China, or allowing your neighbors to snitch on you. Well, that guy is, I don't think they're right. They've got firearms. You go take their firearms. I mean, how does this work? Right? This is French revolutionary nonsense. This is what happened during the French Revolution. I don't think that guy is a citizen. He doesn't say citizen to me. You should investigate that guy. This is the Inquisition. I don't think that guy is Catholic enough. You should go and investigate. And you're guilty until you're proven innocent. They come and they take your firearms based on a supposition or a complaint from somebody. Now, I know that it would be said, well, I mean, we're only going to do this in certain, these people are declared mentally unstable or whatever. But we already do some of these things, right? So as Martin points out, I mean, look, the tradition in America has long been an adherence to civil liberties. And one of those has been firearm possession for all kinds of reasons. I mean, look, the founding generation believed it was necessary for self-defense, for self-preservation, hunting, right? I mean, you had a right to these things. And we know that as firearms are confiscated and taken away, we know that government gets to be more oppressive because there's no threat from anybody. And the whole idea of a citizen militia was that, as many of the proposed quote-unquote Second Amendments pointed out, this was the defense of yourself and your state against invasion. It wasn't until the early 20th century when we get the National Guard that we didn't have the general government prescribing what the militia, which is every able-bodied male citizen of a certain age, had to have in their possession, which was a firearm, a certain amount of powder, ammunition. I mean, this was something that in the Militia Act of the late 18th century, this is what the founding generation did. Look, you have to be armed. You have to be armed. You have to have ammunition. You have to have powder. You have to have a firearm because you're in the militia for the defense of your state against a foreign invasion. And of course, this is just natural because these people would have had these things anyways. And even then, these things were dangerous. Look, firearms are dangerous. There were accidents. There was violence. I mean, these things happened. What we have here is not a gun crisis. We have a moral crisis in America. We have a moral crisis. We have a crisis of men. We have all kinds of, look, we have a leftist crisis. It's a progressive crisis. Progressivism is driving people crazy. Because we don't have that conservative Christian tradition in America any longer as the core value that's holding everything together. The South isn't holding everything together. And so we get craziness. That's why we explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition, to try to stop some of the craziness. Now, the South has always been violent. I mean, one of the most famous books of the 19th century, written by Augusta Jane Evans Wilson, St. Elmo, begins with violence. It's a duel. And she talks about how this was shocking. I mean, Southerners, that code of honor, which led to dueling, it's a very violent thing. Without question, very violent. But that violence was something of a way to try to keep society in line. At least that's what it was thought at the time. This was how you keep people in line, by threatening that. And we, of course, that's not something we want to do today, without question. But that was the argument back in the 19th century. But she begins the book with the duel, and then she reforms the main character over time, makes him a better man. So it's the guiding hand of a very traditional woman that allows that to happen. And this is something, again, as part of the Southern tradition. Women being women, men being men, men being gentlemen and women being ladies. I mean, that's something that was very important in that tradition, and having boundaries and having established parameters. You know, part of the problem that we have with, for example, things like harassment and other issues is because men and women have no bounds anymore. There's no boundaries between the two. So men just think they can say whatever they want because progressivism has taught that that's okay. And women, of course, have helped make these rules, and then they get upset when the rules don't go their way. And then, of course, you have issues with that. But if you had boundaries, if you had boundaries with these things that were part of the gentlemanly code or the code of ladies, well, you wouldn't have as many of these issues anymore. It's about being a gentleman. It's about having the proper conduct in society. And that was the constraints of tradition, to recognize that there were things, boundaries you just didn't cross. We just didn't do it. So, this is where we get these bookend pieces. Now, and the Red Flag Laws piece, which I think Michael Martin does a nice job showing the historical precedent for the quote-unquote Second Amendment, which is just a natural civil liberty for self-defense and to own and possess a way to do that. But the piece on Wednesday, I found it. Now, we didn't publish this piece originally. This is at the Front Porch Republic, which is an interesting website. But it's about sports and the localism of sports. And of course, we know that this is kind of a different piece. It's not so serious. And I like these pieces when we publish these things, but it's about local sports, and root, root, root for the home team is the title of the article. And it's about the college football, baseball. Now the author is from Detroit, and he's very interested in the Southern tradition. Because of its insistence, and I'll Take My Stand, he's read that. He likes that part of it, that local part, regional part of it. And he's very interested in that principle. But he loves baseball because he says it's a national local, right? And I mean, so you have all these baseball teams around the United States, but when it's still a sport that's so tied into the local. It's not like football, which is on the national game of the week, and then you got that on Monday, you got it on Sunday, you got it on Thursday. And It's a, as someone pointed out, I think it was at the Federalist recently, this is the national game. It's about nationalism. It's about everybody, and it's an inclusive game and these kind of things. Well, when you look at baseball, it's the national pastime, but it's still a local game. I root for a team that's not in my local area, and so I pay money to get the broadcast from that area, from where this team plays, and you get all their local commercials. So, I mean, they broadcast local things. I mean, when you watch this ball club, this baseball team, it's all about the region that they're in. And you feel that. I mean, it's very regional. All the teams are that way. It doesn't matter if you're talking about the New York Yankees, the Boston Red Sox, the Atlanta Braves, the Los Angeles Angels, the Seattle Mariners. They all have their own local character, and that makes it fun. And the same thing goes with college football. I mean, there's a reason why the South embraces college football the way that they do, because it's all about the local. It's about your people and your little community against, it's kind of like high school. I mean, that way it's your little community against that community. Even within the state, when you have, in the state I live in, Alabama, you have Alabama and Auburn. Well, I mean, you find in the area that I live, it's very close to Auburn, so it's dominated by Auburn fans. There are Alabama fans, and I have a colleague who's a big Auburn fan, goes to all the football games, he's an Auburn graduate. And he told me the other day, he said that the kindest fans, SEC fans, from an Auburn perspective in the Southeast are Alabama fans. And he said that was the case because, number one, they've been there before. They know what they're doing. They're a great football team and a great program, a storied program. But they're in the same state. And they really are kind, and they just think of it as a fun rivalry. But they're all Alabamians at the end of the day. He said other places don't do that as much. I mean, when you come in, and it's interesting how that works. But you have these intense rivalries between schools and between states because it's all about the local. It's all about the state. So you have Dixie, you have the Southeast, and of course the Southeast is. I mean, it's it. Look, you know, I'll root for the Southeast over any other school. A Southeastern school over any other school because I want the South to do well. It doesn't matter. You know, of course, the South dominates. When you have Clemson against Alabama, that's South Carolina against Alabama at the end of the day is what that is. So the South is going to win no matter what. But if it was Clemson against Ohio State, well, even though I'm not a Clemson fan, I'm going to root for Clemson. If it's Georgia against Notre Dame, you know, I've always liked Notre Dame, but I'm going to root for Georgia. And that's just because, I mean, these are people that I know. I know a lot of Georgia fans. These are people I know, and I want them to be happy about their team. Now, when it comes to professional football, that's a whole nother story. And I think that's another part of that. But, we don't have quote America's team in college football. And we really don't have that in baseball either. We have it in professional football. You could say that maybe the Yankees are the international team for professional baseball, but that still is a New York team, and it has a New York character to it. I mean, just go back to September, it's 2001, and all the things that happened in New York that was focused on New York, the Yankees and the Mets. It's all about New York. So in that way, I mean, here we are. We've got this very local, and I love this piece because it gets into this situation where you have the locals more important than the national. It's wonderful. And so we republished this piece simply because of that. It really hits home to that tradition, that Southern tradition, and sweeping around your own back door and maintaining the local, maintaining the community that you're in and promoting that. And then finally, the last piece of the week on Tuesday is a book review. It's an interesting book review, and it's entitled Deplorable 19th Century American Catholics and the 21st Century Cultural Wars by Jerry Salyer, who's a devout Catholic. The book is Faith and Fury, The Rise of Catholicism During the Civil War. And this is an interesting issue. Where did Catholics stand during the war? You had, of course, Catholics in the North, but you did have Catholics in the South. And as Salyer points out, the Pope, Pius IX, sympathize with the Southern cause. In fact, Father Connor, who wrote this book, concedes that, as Sawyer points out. He says, quote, "The natural conclusion one would draw from the predominance of communication between Richmond and Rome is that Pius IX sympathized with the Southern cause." Sawyer says this, "There's no reason to think that Blessed Pius IX had any special fondness for involuntary servitude. So whatever sympathy he exhibited toward the South must have been rooted in other causes, causes toward which Father Connor occasionally makes a few fleeting gestures. With nationalism, liberalism, and socialist revolution rampant in the 19th century Europe, it is possible that the Pope perceived forces at work in America which were analogous to those which had demolished much of Catholic France and would go on to devour the Papal States. Consolidated, centralized, and progress-obsessed national governments went hand-in-hand with an anti-Catholic spirit, or at least so many Catholics thought. So many of them sided with the South, even as then obscure political theorist named Karl Marx would send a letter of congratulation to President Lincoln following the latter's 1864 re-election. Although he himself clearly subscribes to a fairly conventional understanding of the issues at stake, Father Connor grants that slavery was not the only matter which led to the divisions of 1861. Another stressor was the Tariff of Abominations in 1828, he notes, which set the interests of the North, South, and emerging West against one another. Southern states generally opposed tariffs, which protected Northern industries from foreign competition while raising expenses in its own agrarian economy. It was this tariff crisis, not slavery, Father Connor observes, which promoted John C. Calhoun to elaborate his theory of states' rights and nullification, a theory which many American Catholics found appealing, insofar as it looked to be a bulwark against the emergence of a monolithic Protestant superstate. Moreover, it was the tariff which nearly provoked Calhoun's South Carolina to secede 30 years prior to the Fort Sumter Affair. So, this is interesting because you have this subset of the American South, and as you know, people called Charleston a holy city, you had different denominations in Charleston, and it's important to note that the South was not necessarily monolithic religiously, and so Sawyer, as a devout Catholic, is looking for that in this particular book. And returning to the question of the American Catholic historical consciousness, it is plain that men of goodwill simply cannot sit still as a temporal conflict which saw flaws and virtues on both sides gets recast as an apocalyptic Manichean battle between absolute good and absolute evil. The book's shortcomings and occasional blinkers notwithstanding, it must be said that Faith and Fury simply does not support the Manichean perspective regarding the war, for per the book's thesis, it is only because Catholics on both sides were able to keep their political differences in perspective that the American church avoided schism and was able to emerge from the fire stronger than ever. Those Catholics who are basically comfortable with American culture and where it seems to be headed need not think very long about Father Connor's thesis, much less incorporate it into a critique of the prevailing civic mythology. The rest of us have no choice but to do so. So this is a strong book on the Western tradition and how the South fits into that in Sawyer's reading of the book, and I find that interesting and something that makes it worthwhile to go through and read. And, of course, to digest. And so we have here, again, an interesting take on the Southern tradition. What is that tradition? What does it mean? How is it rooted? We have, on one end, we have the Boyd Cathy explaining the neoconservatives. You could say that, I mean, this fits right into Cathy's piece because he's talking about the neoconservatives. They're conservative. You have many Catholics who are not necessarily in line with traditional American conservatism, and they're fine with what's happening in American culture. They don't see the value in those boxwoods, the hedge. I mean, the boxwoods represent the hedge, right? It's the hedge. It's as Sawyer points out, nullification presented the hedge. The boxwoods were the hedge in the garden. The hedge against the other things, the hedge against Washington, D.C., the hedge against the outside that was the beautiful that was there to be preserved. That's what the boxwoods represented. So the boxwoods, what the tree and our symbol for the Abbeville Institute represents, those roots going into the ground, something that's real and tangible, the traditions of that. And so as we think about the Southern tradition, and as we think about localism and all these other things, this is what we have to remember. It's the Southern tradition has always presented the roots into the ground, the roots in the order of America and in Western civilization. And that's one thing that we want to continually hammer home. I used to say it a lot on this podcast, the South is America. I still believe it. The Southern tradition was America for a long time. The South still is America. And this is something that a lot of people don't like. It's one thing that, as Sawyer says, the deplorables, I mean, that term, but that's who the left talks about. They're generally talking about Southerners. This is what Michael Martin points out in his piece. I mean, the South is essentially being attacked here, but he points out that a lot of these issues take place in northern states. So that Southern tradition is important for America. George Mason is as important as anyone else. And we need to remember that on a continual basis. Until next time, good day.